Good morning. I'm glad we're gathered today, and I'm sure more are coming for this Martin Luther King Day of Service and Learning. I'm Brian Martin Burkholder, campus pastor here at EMU and part of the planning committee, along with many faculty members and other staff, especially from Multicultural and International Student Services. And we're also connected with a broader planning group, the Martin Luther King Jr. Way Coalition, planning for an event at noon at Memorial Hall to celebrate and dedicate the newly named Martin Luther King Jr. Way, which takes off from 42 at the former high school and heads east over almost to 81. For now, it's good to be gathered here at EMU for this chapel, and we welcome community members joining today as well. The theme that we have selected is We Walk the Way of Dr. King. And the theme for the chapel today is A Domesticated King. In just a few minutes, EMU President Dr. Lauren Schwarzentruber will be here to introduce our speaker, Dr. David Evans. And so I'll leave that to him. I'd like to turn over the program right now to Alicia Garza and to London Wheeler, who are leading us in worship. So please come.
Flow to you, let the river of my worship flow to you. Lord, I pray in all I do, let the river of my worship flow to you. Streams in the valley, they swell with the rain. Let the songs of my heart rise to bless your name and flow to you, flow to you. Lord, let my worship flow.
Thank you. It's my honor to introduce a colleague and a friend, Dr. David Evans. Many of you know him as the Assistant Professor of History and Mission here at Eastern Mennonite Seminary, and he has worked prior to coming to EMS in a variety of ministry contexts. While living in Washington, D.C., David was the junior and senior high director of an out-of-school time program on Capitol Hill. He later served as Community Development Resource Coordinator with Mennonite Central Committee East Coast, and most recently was co-pastor of the Boonton United Methodist Church in New Jersey. David loves to spend time with his wife Faith and his two boys Isaac, 14, and Solomon, 7, and his daughter Sarah Grace, age 6 weeks. And he says they are sleeping, actually. He finds joy in playing and watching basketball and soccer. He's also an avid music enthusiast. And above all else, he would like to be known as someone who loves God with deep conviction and loves God's people with a heart that is wide open. David received a bachelor's degree in Christian ministries from Spring Arbor College in Spring Arbor, Michigan. He received a master's in theological studies with a focus on the history of Christianity from Wesley Theological Seminary, a Master of Philosophy from Drew University, and a PhD from the Drew University Graduate Division of Religion and Historical Studies. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Evans.
Good morning. It is a privilege and an honor to be with you this morning. Thank you for that introduction, President Schwarzendrupper. I'd like to also thank the MLK Planning Committee for inviting me to share with you this morning. It is no small thing for someone like myself to deliver a message on MLK Day, especially when I consider that I don't think I would be here were it not for the life, the legacy, the work, and the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Nor do I think that I would share in the love of my family quite in the way that I do today. Some of you are familiar with the reality that as late or as early as 1967, 50 years ago, in this very state, people who were in mixed racial marriages were not recognized by the law. My wife is white. My children are mixed. And without the civil rights movement and people who sacrificed their lives and showed great courage like Martin Luther King Jr. did, we would not be enjoying the life here in Harrisonburg that we do today. Well, for many of us, this history is beyond the span of our life. And so we come by way of Martin Luther King Jr. by things that have been passed down to us. If you're under 35 years old this morning, you may feel that you have been celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s life for your entire life. You don't remember a time when you did not. Well, that's certainly the way that I feel. I feel as though I've been celebrating MLK Day for as long as I can remember. When I was a kid, my family, my brothers and I, my mother would take us to every MLK celebration that she could find every year. And despite the fact that the churches and the community organizations seemed to say the same thing year after year, they never failed to remind us. Again and again, the churches and the pastors would remind us that yes, King was a doctor, but he was also a reverend. He was a godly man, and first and foremost, he was a Christian. These sermons could probably be entitled something like "The King I Never Knew," or really "The King You Never Knew," and I'm going to tell you what you should know. He was a Christian, a reverend, not just a learned man, but a godly man. But as I've learned more and more and studied King, I've come to recognize that people want to emphasize different aspects of his life and remind us of things that will help us understand, to learn from him so that we can grow and be more like him. Others have emphasized that King was a doctor. At 27 years old, the man graduated from Boston University with a PhD. Incredible. He was a civil rights leader. And those who would remind us that he led the cause of civil rights would also remind us that he wasn't a lone ranger. He didn't do this on his own. No, King was thrust into leadership by and surrounded himself with courageous and talented leaders who helped him through this great civil rights battle. But I think one of the most dominant images we have of King is the one we see here. And that is that King was a man with a dream, right? The most dominant image of our domestic imagination concerning King was that he was a man with a dream. He was a nice black man, a gentle black man that kids can learn a lot from. They can watch his clips on YouTube where he talks about the dream that he had that one day his kids, black kids, would sit down with little white kids. And then we take our kids and we ask them to share in the dream of Dr. King. I don't know if you can read this from out there, but I found this little homework assignment on the internet. The website was called Funny Schoolwork Fails. Apparently, we're supposed to find humor in this young person's work. It says at the top, Dr. King had a dream. My dream is, and the young person says, to work at Taco Bell with my mama. Well, I think we are supposed to find it funny because somehow this kid doesn't seem to understand the context of what this dream is about. That's not what King's dream is about, working at Taco Bell. No, the context of King's dream is something else. But I think that all of us share in a little bit of disconnect, not just this young person, around what King's dream was all about. See, we don't understand the context of the I Have a Dream speech, which is only one part of a longer speech entitled Normalcy No More. We don't know that the speech was given at a march for freedom and jobs, maybe, maybe this youth knew a little bit more about what King's speech was about than we think. But we've tamed the speech. We've broken it into sound bites so that it no longer carries the weight of the context in which it was first spoken. We've domesticated the dream. And I fear we've domesticated King. Yes, King was a reverend. Yes, King was a doctor. And yes, King was a leader. Yes, King had a dream. But King has become so much a part of the everyday fabric of our lives that I fear that this reverend, this leader of a civil rights movement, has become our reverend, our doctor, our leader. His dream is like our dream, like our dreams. In other words, we've domesticated him. We've made him palatable to our own image, to our own desires, our own imagination of what it is that we want to see in our world. And it's also to say that we have made him less than the revolutionary that he was. To say that we've domesticated him is to point out that King has become a fixture of our national memory. Think about it, just about every major city you go to has an MLK street. We even have one right here in Harrisonburg now. There are MLK statues, larger-than-life statues, and MLK moments in school to remember him. And these are good things. But it's also to say that by domesticating him, we've made him too big to imitate and perhaps too nice to matter. I think too many of us forget that though today Reverend King is revered, yesteryear, he was reviled. We forget on a day like today, as we have participated in and celebrated year after year, MLK Day and celebrations and marches and maybe days of service, and we've heard talks like this one. We forget that when MLK Day was adopted, it took 14 years of struggle in order to get there. In 1969, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference that had thrust Martin Luther King into leadership in the civil rights movement years earlier introduced a petition that was signed by more than 3 million people to support a King holiday. But in 1969, just a year after his death, there was no consensus on the goodness of this man. During the civil rights era, he was called all kinds of things, some of which I cannot or I dare not repeat in chapel this morning. But I'll share with you a few of them so that you can get an understanding of why it was that some people did not find it helpful or desirable to have him be honored in such a way. He was called a communist at a time when there was little worse in the United States of America than being called a communist, because it connoted that you were godless or anti-American. He was called an outside agitator, and many of us are familiar with his words in the letter from a Birmingham jail where he rebutted 8 white Southern Christian ministers who said that his presence in Birmingham was unwarranted because he didn't come from there. He was called an extremist. He was viewed as one who was impatient and unwilling to allow for a period of quietness and moderation, as the Reverend Billy Graham, the white evangelist that so many of us know of, criticized him publicly, though they were friends. He was called lawless because he was willing to march and protest in public streets, even though there were laws that said that you shouldn't do so. Now, one of the most inspiring stories that I heard as a young person, I continue to gather strength and inspiration from, is one from 1962. He was speaking to an audience much like this one when out of the crowd, well, I guess it was a little different. Most of the faces were a little darker, but there was one pale-skinned face in the crowd wearing a white t-shirt. And he had heard enough of what Dr. King had to say, and so he came up on the platform and began to punch Dr. King in the face. After a few hits, a few strikes in the face, King lowered his arms, refusing to defend himself, and then softly spoke to the man in the crowd, telling them to let him be. When the police arrived later, he refused to press charges. But I think this incident shows us a number of things. It shows us the character of King, but it also shows us that there was incredible hatred and venom that was pointed at King and his movement. We could talk more about other ways in which his family and he suffered violence. His house was firebombed. His wife and his 1-year-old daughter were almost killed. His family would receive threatening phone calls on regular occasion. And in one sermon, he said that he heard one phone call and put the phone down, and it shook him to his core so much so that he said he had reached a saturation point. He was ready to quit, ready to give up. And we thank God this morning that he did not. By the time he preached his last sermon, "I have been to the mountaintop," it seems that King was convinced that his days were numbered, that it wouldn't be long before he would be dead. Someone would kill him. Bernice King, his daughter, and Jesse Jackson, the reverend and civil rights leader who walked with King, have said that at the time of his death, Martin Luther King Jr. was probably one of the most hated men in America. Now, knowing all of this, you might suspect, or you might come to understand a reason why it was that the petition to have MLK Day become a federal holiday in 1969 was denied. It took 14 years. Not until 1983 that MLK became one of 3 people to have a federally recognized holiday in his name. The other 2, George Washington, Christopher Columbus. And not every state adopted this holiday. If you grew up in Arizona or you grew up in South Carolina, it would be years in waiting before this federal holiday would be adopted in those states. But I want to ask us a question this morning. Because knowing all of this, we might wonder how it is that we all got here. We're not here to see Dr. David Evans. We're here to honor the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a man who was hated, a man who was despised. So how is it that we can go, or we can see a man go from a public enemy to a national symbol for peace, a person who was maligned around dinner tables to an American hero, an enemy of the state to one of three people who have a federal holiday in their honor? Well, in short, my answer this morning is that we've domesticated him. We've memorialized him the way that we memorialize our heroes and our saints, so that we can create an emotional connection and attachment to them. And it's a good thing to remember. It's a good thing to memorialize. But sometimes in order to do so, we've got to smooth out the jagged and sharp edges that make us feel uncomfortable. And there's a lot to feel uncomfortable with around the memory of King, especially if you're one who's comfortable with the way things are, especially if you're one who's comfortable with amassing wealth, especially if you're one who's comfortable with feeling as though you're superior to those who have less or who look different than you. If you find security in having the world's largest army, you might feel a little uncomfortable if you listen to the words of Dr. King. But we want our feelings around those who we remember to feel good, so we can feel close to them and we can feel like they are one of us. So our memories cannot include the discontent, the anger, and the maladjustment that King felt and spoke about so often. Our memory of King has been domesticated. And that's the purpose of memorials, to detach heroic energy of a person or event to our national consciousness. Memorials always exist somewhere between history and fiction, or as one historian has put it, between history and memory. These memories, as 30-somethings can attest, are not our own, but they are given to us. And these memories play up the memory of his dream, but they play down his history of critiquing the triple evils of racism, militarism, and materialism that I want to talk about this morning. You see, King was not nice. You know what nice means. Nice means that you go along to get along. You don't make waves. You don't make people feel uncomfortable. And if you think they might, you try to ease their discomfort. That's being nice. King wasn't nice. He was angry. And he was confrontational. King could not be domesticated in the 1960s. He called himself maladjusted and discontented. Divinely so, he would add. Maladjusted and discontented with racism, militarism, and materialism of the United States. But King's history is at odds with our memory. For memorialists, I think King represents the best of the colorblind dream. King apparently, in their minds, wanted to do away with racism by getting rid of racial differences. So King came to symbolize the safe side of Black America. You've heard this before, you're familiar with this idea, right? He's the anti-Black supremacist, the nice Black man. He's not Malcolm X. He's not the one who confronted white people and talked about separation. And it's true, he did not talk about separation. But neither one was he one who was shy about confrontation or wanted to be colorblind. And I should add that the two, Malcolm and Martin, were not adversaries. James Cone has written in his text, Malcolm and Martin, that although the media portrayed them as adversaries, Martin and Malcolm were actually fond of each other. There was no animosity between them. If you go online, you can see pictures of them shaking hands and smiling with one another. Martin showed up one time at a meeting, at a march, right? And he attracted the attention of the folks in town towards him in a way of saying, hey, if you don't like what this guy is proposing, just wait till you see me. Right? But that was his way of helping. And King appreciated it, although they saw the process quite differently. When it comes to racism, I think we do a disservice to King when we domesticate him. He was not a colorblind king. He was a black king. He did not advocate a colorblind society. He found value in his black racial heritage. One biographer wrote that he often felt deep anger towards white society, and it showed up from time to time in his speeches and in his writings. If you're familiar with the letter from a Birmingham jail, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. In 1967 in Cleveland, he has addressed his feelings about black pride by saying this. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure and high and clean. Well, I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language right so that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black. I'm proud of it. I'm black and I'm beautiful. Now, this is not a statement of personal identity only. It's also a statement, a public proclamation against white supremacy. If you live in a world that has defined beauty by the brightness of your hair, the color of your eyes, and the paleness of your skin, then to say in the face of all that, that dark is something to be desired, it's something that's good and beautiful, is to confront that system head on. King sought equality for all people, no doubt, but he laid the inequities of society, racism, classism, and the drafting of young brown and black men into military inscription at the feet of white society. His words conveyed that black pride was necessary in racial healing and in the healing of society. But racism was not the only problem he addressed. One of his final initiatives was to start a poor people's campaign to end poverty. I get a little troubled, disturbed, when Martin Luther King Day activities say nothing of the structural forces at work behind poverty. Unfortunately, King Day has become, for many, a day, an exercise in practicing good citizenship, and serving from a perch of privilege, and then returning to life as normal as one who will excel at pursuing the American dream, adding perhaps that they've done a little service on their resume. And I think this is ultimately the problem with materialism. Everything has a price, even King's memory. The American dream, in essence, is the pursuit of wealth, a pursuit often undertaken with little regard for those who have limited access to the capitalist system. But King opposed the commodification of people. We'd have a hard time domesticating King on economics. In addition to being a black king, he was a poor king. And one of the reasons King was suspected of being a communist was because of his support for labor unions. His view was that labor unions were the first to fight for the poor in America. He was against slogans like right to work, the idea that people should not have to pay union dues if there is a union associated with their institution of employment, because he felt it would rob people of their civil rights and job rights. He said in 1961 that in our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. It is a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions of everyone. Wherever these laws have been passed, wages are lower, job opportunities are fewer, and there are no civil rights. We do not intend to let them do this. We demand this fraud be stopped. And our weapon is our vote. Now, King was not a communist. He made it very clear that he was not. He made many remarks on this front. But one of his aides was a member of the Communist Party, which was one of the reasons why the FBI authorized that he be investigated. He was a labor supporter. Now, it doesn't look like my entire quote made it up there. But this support connected him to poor blacks, poor whites, and the poor of all races across the nation. The white establishment pitted black and white against each other for the sake of greenbacks or the almighty dollar. He came to see that racism was lucrative business for some, and because of this, he began to address the inequities within the U.S. economic system. In a message in Michigan in 1968, he said, "I would say millions of people in the Negro community are poverty-stricken, not because they are not working, but because they receive low wages, so low they cannot begin to function in the mainstream of the economic life of our nation. Most of the poverty-stricken people of America are persons who are working every day. They end up getting part-time wages for full-time work." Sound familiar? Perhaps things haven't changed as much as we want them to, but we'll get to that in a moment. He concluded that the next priority of the federal government should be to raise the minimum wage, a fight we continue to have. And domesticating King makes him everyone's hero. But as I said earlier, it softens the message, the sharp edges of his message. One component of the domestication of King is that King Day has become a day for all to comfortably celebrate him, regardless of what or who they represent. Last year, on the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech, you might remember that the commander-in-chief of the world's most powerful military, President Barack Obama, gave an MLK address in his honor. And I wonder, and I invite you to wonder with me, what does it mean to have the leader of the world's most powerful army give a speech on behalf of a man who opposed military violence in all its forms? King was not the king of American exceptionalism. He wasn't the king of American imperialism. Rather, King was a radically nonviolent man opposed to the proliferation of military violence in the world. Many of us, in the spirit of personal pacifism and sometimes just getting along, have shared words from King, and there's lots of words to share, to talk about how much we like his nonviolent spirit. You may have heard quotes like this: "Nonviolence means avoiding not only external violence, but also internal violence of spirit. You not only refuse to shoot a man, but you refuse to hate him." And white people have used words like these to argue that people of color need to show more sympathy towards whites and agree to get along, because that's what King taught, that's what King would want. Haven't you heard the words of Dr. King? But King had far more sympathy for the anger of blacks than we often are comfortable acknowledging. It's true that he didn't condone violence, and he often told those who wanted to join his movement, "If you can't be nonviolent, stay home, don't come." But most of his words, I think we need to remember, were not aimed at black youth. They were aimed at the U.S. government. In a 1967 speech entitled, "Why I'm Opposed to the Vietnam War," he said this: "As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I've tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they asked, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They asked if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent," he said. King's dream was the end of white supremacy, the end of racial oppression, economic exploitation, and worldwide violence. And to confront these injustices, he had to confront white America. And for this, he was hated. For this, he was killed. To speak of King without recognizing his blackness, his campaign against poverty, and disdain for war is to further domesticate him. But the King of the Civil Rights Movement could not be domesticated. He was dangerous, which is why today he's dead. King would tell us, I think, that to confront the issues we face, we must be divinely discontented. In a speech entitled Creative Maladjustment, King said, if these problems are to be solved, there must be a sort of divine discontent all over the nation. Are you divinely discontented? Are you maladjusted? Are you uncomfortable with the way things are? Do you have eyes to see, Jesus would say. Today's memory of him does not teach us to be divinely discontent. We're instead taught to pursue success, power, and whatever career path pays the most. We're instead taught to be satisfied with the status quo, to believe that we have arrived, that we have perfected our union. I mean, look at our president, for goodness sakes. That all that is left is for us to go out to other lands and spread democracy in the American gospel. And why not, if we have arrived? I mean, we have, right? We've arrived. King has a holiday. We have arrived. Children everywhere will speak of their dreams today and for the rest of this week. We have arrived. A larger-than-life statue of King stands tall on the National Mall. No other non-president can say that. What I find troubling is that our memory of a giant king comforts us more than the history of this small man. By small, I don't mean just that he was 5'7", about my height, but that he wasn't larger than life. Perhaps you've heard about his average grades in school, though we must say that he was above average in intellect. I'm sure you've heard how young he was when he joined the civil rights movement and how young he was when he died. And many of us have heard about his extramarital affairs that we found out about through wiretapping of the FBI. And we were disturbed, deeply disturbed and troubled by what we heard. But I also think that we were afraid, that this news frightened us. And it's frightening because so long as King is our size, his actions are not beyond our reach. This is frightening because as long as he is our age, then his recommendations for what needs to happen in society need not wait until we get a little bit older, a little more seasoned. And I think this is frightening because so long as he has made himself vulnerable to ridicule, we can't use our fear as an excuse to be so shamefully adjusted to life as it is. We can't continue to allow ourselves to be content with the domestication of Martin Luther King Jr. or what he stood for. We can't continue to turn a blind eye to the most troublesome component, at least in my opinion, of postmodernism. And that is the commodification of values, the willingness to have our souls bought to fuel the global capitalist machine. Justice, my friends, is more than an employment skill set. Cultural intelligence is greater than a vocational competency. And being in solidarity with the economically impoverished in the world is beyond something to pad your resume with. These are fundamental components of what it means to be human. How many times do we see people in the civil rights movement just saying this, I am a man. I am somebody. And to march and to preach and to take courage is to claim our humanity. But that's something I seldom heard about King growing up, that he was human, that he was my size. Recently, in my studies of missions, as a professor of mission here at Eastern Mennonite University and Eastern Mennonite Seminary, I came across a sermon that showed me another side of King that I didn't know. One thing I never heard in all of the teachings about him being a Christian and a reverend was that he was a missionary, that he was an innovator of cross-cultural ministry. So when I read the outline of one of his sermons, Redirecting Our Missionary Zeal, I was struck when he criticized Christian missions for being so foreign in nature. He wanted Christians to become missionaries and to begin with white society, because in his views, the triple evils of racism, militarism, and materialism were maintained by the majority of people in power in the United States. People who live suburban, economically privileged lives, and those people were leaders of and supported by white systems and institutions. And most of these people called themselves Christians. In that sermon, King quoted E. Stanley Jones, who said that we are inoculating the world with a mild form of Christianity. And then he went on to tell his audience they needed to be maladjusted, as he would become fond of saying. He said, "I say to you, my friends, there are certain things in our nation, in the world, of which I am proud to be maladjusted." And I think he would say to us today, he would say to us now, be maladjusted to the military-industrial complex. Be maladjusted to the materialistic propaganda of our consumerist culture. Be discontent with discrimination against people because they speak a different dialect. Be discontent with the denigration of the newest immigrants who are building this nation with their bare hands. But unfortunately, too many of us have adjusted ourselves to life as presented to us. We've grown content with pursuing the American dream with little service thrown in. If we're going to emphasize that King was a dreamer, then let us also emphasize and recognize that dreamers are always discontented people. It's almost like a prerequisite to have a dream. Something's not right and there's something better on the horizon. And his discontent led him to become a Christian missionary. So let me conclude with this. When King read the gospel, the words that said, "Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit," he did not fail to remember that the United States is one of those nations in need of discipleship. He knew that there was work to be done right here at home. If you notice that picture, there is a picture of Harrisonburg, where we are. It astounded him that those who championed white supremacy and the subjugation of non-whites could call themselves Christians and go to foreign fields preaching and teaching when they themselves were in great need of a savior from the wounding of their own racism, the malady of materialism, and the self-destructive mentality of militarism. My friends, we don't start by saving the world when our own souls or the souls of our neighbors are in jeopardy. We start right here, even in the Shenandoah Valley, even in Harrisonburg, not only by becoming neighbors to the poor, but by challenging the rich, the wealthy, the comfortable, the complacent. King said it this way, "All I am saying leads to this. Along with our work on the foreign field, we must begin to do missionary work right here. Each of us must do this. And we must begin with the white man." In other words, if black and brown people were suffering from racial oppression in the form of economic poverty, then white society was suffering from the psychological and spiritual wounds of internalized racial superiority, which left them far from the heart of God. And we cannot allow ourselves to be adjusted to that kind of situation. We can't allow ourselves to be adjusted to the situation in which we find ourselves today, where there is a pipeline of school to prison, where 1 in 3 African American men can expect to spend some time in their life in prison. We can't allow ourselves to be adjusted to an education system built on furthering the wealth and economic growth of a few. We can't continue to be adjusted to an oligarchy where the economically rich get richer and the economically poor are not even acknowledged. We cannot allow ourselves to be adjusted to a situation wherein people are not welcome in our Christian communities because of whom they choose to love. Instead, we need to be maladjusted, be divinely discontented, and we must not allow King to be domesticated any longer. For if we are to truly walk in the way of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the missionary, then we must be willing to walk as he walked.
Pray briefly with me. Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. Lord, have mercy as we acknowledge our complicity and God, empower us in the way of Martin Luther King Jr. Indeed, empower us in the way of Jesus Christ. As maladjusted, impassioned followers of Jesus. Amen.